Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The U.S. government should return stolen land from Native Americans to combat ongoing and systemic racial discrimination. That was the recommendation of U.N. Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, James Anaya. On April 23rd, he began a 12-day fact-finding investigation looking into the lives and struggles of Indigenous peoples and tribes in Washington, D.C., Arizona, Alaska, Oregon, Washington State, South Dakota, and Oklahoma. He said, quote, "The indigenous peoples of this country suffer from poverty, poor health conditions, lack of attainment of formal education, and social ills at rates that far exceed those of other segments of the American population. These conditions are related to a history of wrongs that they have suffered." He will formally present his findings in September, and he notes that not one member of Congress agreed to meet with him to talk about his 12-day fact-finding investigation. There are roughly 310 Indian reservations and 564 federally recognized tribes in the United States. In the new book, Res Life, today's guest, David Troyer, writes, quote, "Most people will go a lifetime without ever knowing an Indian or spending any time on an Indian reservation. Indian land makes up 2.3% of the land in the U.S. We number slightly over 2 million, up significantly from not quite 240,000 in 1900. It's pretty easy to avoid us and our reservations, yet Americans are captivated by Indians." Res Life focuses on where reservations came from, how they changed, and what life is like on the res today. David is an Ojibwe Indian and grew up on the Leech Lake Reservation in northern Minnesota. He's the author of three novels and a book of literary criticism. He's a professor of literature and creative writing at USC. He divides his time between Los Angeles and Leech Lake Reservation in Minnesota. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. And we are also joined by one of David's students, Krista Kling. She's an American Indian undergrad student at Bemidji State University, and she and her family have ties to the Boise Fort Reservation and Leech Lake Reservation in Minnesota. Hi, Krista. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
It's great to have you. So
I should say it's Krista Kling.
Oh, Kling. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Krista Kling, and Krista I'm from Boise Fort in Spirit Lake, North Dakota.
Okay, thank you. So thank you both for joining us. Well, let's first start off by talking about this piece of news that got a lot of attention overseas, a little bit of attention here in the U.S., but not that much. David, what was your reaction when you heard about the recommendations from the U.N. Rapporteur James Anaya that the United States government should give back stolen land to Native Americans?
I wasn't surprised that the UN found that the problem of the theft of land exists, and I was pleased and encouraged and quite happy that the United Nations is now saying what Native people have been saying for a good long while, that there's a chance to, still a chance to do right.
It was also interesting, the UN Rapporteur said that not one member of Congress agreed to meet with him, and he said that is fairly unusual for something like this.
It is pretty unusual, but Native American tribes, American Indian tribes are, we consider ourselves and we're understood legally as being sovereign nations, but that sovereignty is complicated. And so the United States has always resisted intervention in our lives to the extent that they don't want what they consider foreign countries meddling with our sovereign nations and bypassing the United States. So it's about power, but these things often are.
He said, "I'm talking about restoring to indigenous peoples what obviously they're entitled to, and they have a legitimate claim to in a way that is not divisive but restorative. That's the idea behind reconciliation." Krista, what was your response when you heard about this?
I wasn't exactly sure. With the restoring, I'm not sure what they were saying that they were going to give back. they've already taken away so much, or we've lost so much, it's kind of hard to give back something that we ourselves had lost.
Well, right. They're not that specific. They basically say some land, including Mount Rushmore, for example. But I understand that in September, there will be more of a formal recommendation, and we might know more at that time. We actually invited James Anaya on the show today, but he wasn't available. But the fact that he says return stolen land, I mean, you don't hear most politicians even use that language. So do you think this was significant, Krista?
I know there's a lot of tribes that a lot of the land is sacred to them, and then a lot of them also believe that once this land has been turned into something else, that they kind of don't want it back. But at the same time, I mean, you're giving back this land that you've kind of trampled on, built on. It's been used and destroyed.
Well, and the other thing he wanted to do is really bring attention to racial discrimination, the poverty faced by many people on Indian reservations. Do you think something like that raises awareness at all, David?
Bringing attention to issues of poverty and discrimination?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Do you think something like this recommendation will at least bring these issues that rarely get attention in the national media?
Well, I guess I would dispute the idea that these issues rarely get attention in the national media. It's been a strange year, probably because it's an election year, but there's been a lot of coverage of Native issues. And it's cyclical. Native issues, especially those dark, drastic stories about how tough life is, are reported every few years or so. And although I'm glad that people are thinking about, you know, the shape of our lives, it's been reported before, and our lives haven't changed that much as a result of the reporting. So that was part of the thinking behind the book Reservation Life, and it's actually part of the thinking behind the course that Krista is a student in. I've known Krista, by the way, since she was just a little kid, and I'm really encouraged and really impressed by the woman she's become and the student she is and the thinker she is, and so I'm really glad she's here for the show. But that was some of the thinking behind Reservation Life, the book. Was I wanted to try and find some other way to think about our lives that got beyond the tragic kind of stories of loss and poverty. And I really wanted to emphasize the fact that our history and our lives are more than the sum of what we've survived or the sum of our troubles. Well, there's a lot more going on.
Well, it's interesting because Diane Sawyer went to Pine Ridge, I believe it was earlier this year, and focused on poverty and, the usual story, it's alcohol and casinos, although there are no casinos there. But a number of children responded to the report saying there's more to us than poverty. And it was a really nice video that they put together to say that every time you come here, you focus on the negative aspects, but there's so much more to us. So talk a little bit about why you wrote this book, because I understand you never really planned on writing nonfiction because you're a novelist, but there was a school shooting in 2005 on the Red Lake Reservation. And the coverage led you to believe that Native people really needed a different narrative. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. I mean, first, mad props to Diane Sawyer for her politics and wanting to draw attention to poverty. That said, the video that the students from Rosebud Reservation put together in response to Diane Sawyer's special Children of the Plains was, to me, a lot more powerful and a lot more interesting than the Children of the Plains, than the story that Sawyer put together. The book Res Life and the course I'm teaching now that Krista's in, we're trying to emphasize not just ways in which we can remember or pay attention to a certain set of facts about contemporary Indian lives. What we're trying to do in the class and what I was really trying to do in the book and why I wrote the book was trying to find some other way of seeing, some other way of telling the story about our lives. Because I think the problem is in part in the telling, not just in what's being told.
Right. So talk a little bit more about that. I mean, the course you teach is called Writing on the Res, and it's a month-long mm-hmm. course bringing 12 USC students to Leech Lake Reservation for a month-long immersion writing experience.
Well, that's only half the equation. There are students from the University of Southern California. There are also students from Bemidji. This is very much a class about coming together from a variety of different backgrounds. some Native, some not. All of us, I think, you know, deeply interested in and deeply concerned about how we think about Native lives. And that was my thinking about the book, too, that I really wanted to take an opportunity to try and to find and to see and to share all of the contradictions and paradoxes and complexities of contemporary reservation life. And that's exactly what we're trying to do in the class as well.
Can you talk a little bit about the class, Krista? And what is the story that you hope to tell about Native life?
Like we said, like a lot of the public focuses on the tragedies that go on in the reservations. I mean, we could talk about those for days. But then as well, like a lot of the stories that we're reading and talking about, I was like, I lived in Cass Lake. I went to school with all of these kids, and that's not the side of the story that I would have told had I told that story. And I think that's, I just want to get that perspective out there as well, that, I mean, bad things happen to everybody, but also very good things happen, and there's a lot of growth that is going on and in Leech Lake, and I'd like to show that.
It's like, can you be more specific? What kind of growth?
We're having, like, it goes as far as, like, the immersion school out there, the Nagani Ojibwe language school, and then just simple things. Like, for instance, I'm in school. We're getting the American Indian population rate at BSU is just rising and rising. I'm part of the Peer Mentor Ambassadors, and we recruit Native American students. And since we've started, the population is increasing drastically every year. It's just small things like that that matter.
Right. Well, and David, what are you hearing from your students in terms of the kinds of stories they want to tell?
Well, you know, it's funny because most of our discussions in class, when we're critiquing a lot of written work, a lot of the discussions are fairly, they're complicated and they're somewhat angry discussions in that we feel like a lot of the work that we've read doesn't quite capture life and actually cheats it in a way. And in contrast, a lot of the issues we discuss when we go out in the communities and we do documentary work and we interview people and talk to them are stories of people who are living really complex, really textured lives that fall outside the usual ways we have of seeing and thinking about how a Native person is, what a Native person does, what life is like, how people's daily lives are defined. And I think this, if I could sum it up, and we're only a week and a half into the course, what we've seen so far is not poverty, but richness of opinion, of lifestyle, of interest and politics. And it's been, so far for me, it's really been a wonderful, life-changing experience. They'd have to tell you for themselves if they think the same way, because you know, I'm grading their papers. I'm grading mine. So they might feel differently.
We're speaking with David Troyer. He is author of the new book, Res Life, An Indian's Journey Through Reservation Life. He writes, a lot of people, this includes Indians and non-Indians, do not think of the story of Res Life as a story of beauty. Most often, Res Life is associated with tragedy. We are thought of in terms of what we have lost or what we have survived. And we'd love to hear from you. If you're a Native American, what story would you like to tell? And if you've been to a reservation, most people have not. Most people have never, or at least think they've never met a Native American. When I went to the Indian Museum in D.C., I remember talking to people who work there who say 80% of the people that come in that museum have never met a Native American before. It's the very first time. So if you've been on a reservation or have lived on a reservation, what's your experience like? And what do you think of the UN's recommendation that the U.S. government should return stolen land to indigenous peoples? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. David, why don't we talk for a little bit about the process involved in writing your book and what that was like for you? Because I understand it took you 7 years to write this book.
Something like that. It makes it sound like a really long book, but it's not. We launched the project. We found an incredible publisher for the project who was as committed as I was. And then I set about and floundered about for a few years. It was really difficult for me. I'm both a private person, and I really cherish my relationships with the people I know that I've made over the years, and those are important to me as a man, as a human being. And it was very uncomfortable to then, but it felt necessary to talk to the people I knew and the people that I loved, the people I was friends with, and to interview them and then write about them and to write about myself. It was very uncomfortable, but it felt necessary, and I'm really happy with that, how it turned out. But, you know, it was one of these projects where you fail and fail and fail and fail and fail again until you succeed. Hmm. And it was hard.
Well, you tell the story, for example, of your mother and father. Your father, David Troyer, is an Austrian Jew and Holocaust...
Robert Troyer.
I'm sorry, Robert. And yeah. A Holocaust survivor. And Margaret, is it Seeley?
Yeah.
She's a tribal court judge. So, you know, I always wonder, when you think about your background, are you in tune with both sides of your family? I mean, are you also in tune with your father's side?
Well, thanks to Germany, there isn't a whole lot of my father's side left. There are a few members of the family who escaped, as my father did, and they remain close, and they're a big part of my life growing up. And, you know, the things my father would talk about and my relatives would talk about, and they're not only they're the legacy of Holocaust, but also their passions and interests. They were very political, very socialist, very very left-leaning, very engaged, working-class people, for the most part, you know, hard-working people. And it was just a subject of conversation so much that it, of course, you know, had a profound impact on who I am. of course, I got teased, too. Now, there aren't many half-Jewish, half-Native American kids running around.
Right.
There are more than you would think.
Really?
Sure.
Because I've never met one.
I've met tons. Yeah, we have our own support group.
Huh.
And we don't. But when I was in college, a friend of mine said, "So you're half Jewish, you're half Native American." He says, "I don't know really what to call you." He says, "Oh wait, I got it. I'll call you Running Bernstein." and he did.
Well, you know, this is fascinating to me because half of my family is Native American, and it's interesting to kind of, do you call yourself Native American because you're half? But when you're half Jewish and half Native American, what I find so interesting is when you look at the history that people in this country know, you know, so many, obviously, probably everybody knows about the Holocaust. So very few people really know the details of Native American history. And, you know, for example, the Indian Museum in D.C. was criticized by the American Indian Movement because the word Holocaust is not involved in the museum. So what are your, I mean, when I found out you were going to be on the show, I just couldn't wait to ask you this question just about history and the fact that so many people know about the Jewish Holocaust, but not the Native American Holocaust.
Well, you know, I'm guessing that since there is a Holocaust Museum in D.C., not far from the National Museum of the American Indian, they probably wanted to make sure that there'd be no confusion for people who wanted to see them. So I don't know if AIM thought of that or not, but I'm sure that was a consideration. And this is an issue we talked about in class, right, Krista?
Yeah.
We talked about this just 2 days ago. You know, I think language is... you know, fits the circumstance, and you use what language works depending on what your agenda is. Sometimes I think it is really helpful if people think about our experience in terms of Holocaust. In some ways, I don't think it's helpful. I think a lot of people are really comfortable with the idea they have, wrongly, that we have been destroyed.
Right. Well, and that was...
And
that, go ahead.
Holocaust reinforces that impression. So in those instances, I think it's a word best not used.
Well, and that was the argument of a lot of the people that work at the museum. And they say, look, if you've got people from all over the world coming here who've never met a Native American before, we also want to show them the richness of the culture and much more than just the genocide. So Krista, what have you all been talking about on this specific issue?
Well, yeah, we brought up using the word genocide as well, like, just the meaning behind it, the definition, and it's kind of more open-ended than the Holocaust. And we talked about what is left and what we still have to carry on.
Well, let's take a caller before we go to break. Let's hear from Lorna in Napa. Hi, Lorna. Welcome to the show.
Hi, David. I'm reading your book right now.
Hey, Lorna. I hope you're having a good time.
Oh, yeah. I actually grew up north of Bemidji. And
nice.
And we had a big farm, kind of up by Pinewood.
Yeah, and, I know where that is.
My dad was part Cherokee Indian, and so he thought it was really important to instill some Native American culture in me. And so when the Indians would have their powwows up at Red Lake, we'd all go up there, and I remember dancing in the palace as a little girl, and I always really enjoyed it. And we used to bring our vegetables up to the reservation from our farm, and then we would trade with the Indians for their smoked northern, and I think they gave us smoked walleye too. It was very good. But
see,
sorry.
No, you go ahead. I thought you were done. Continue, please.
Well, I always felt compelled that we should really, help the Native Americans in terms of their diet, the foods that they get from the federal government for their staples are just prone to lead to heart disease and diabetes. The rations that they get are just awful, in my opinion. And so I think that really promotes, an unhealthy lifestyle for the people that have to live on that type of food. And that's one criticism I have of the U.S. government. And another is, Leonard Peltier, he's still locked up in prison for probably something that he was stonewalled into. And the federal government is probably never going to let that man be released. They'll want to see him die in prison. And I just would like to know how we could get him free. Good question.
Well, first, you sound like a really great neighbor.
Yeah.
You know?
I wish I would have met you. Because what year did you graduate high school?
88.
Yeah, I graduated 84. Did you go to Catholic?
No, Bemidji.
Oh, really? Well, then.
Yes.
I graduated in 84, and I probably, your name sounds familiar, but.
Well, I was just a little kind of annoying kid anyway. You wouldn't have liked me much. But, you sound like, you and your family sound like great neighbors, and those are the kinds of relationships that I think there are more of those kinds of relationships like you had. Than people often imagine there are. People working together and visiting each other and checking out what the other does and sharing food. That just sounds really wonderful. And I think there's more than we imagine, and I think there could be a lot more of that kind of thing. I think it sounds like your dad was pretty cool. As far as Leonard Peltier, there's a range of opinions about him and about whether or not he's actually innocent or guilty. A lot of people are passionately invested in his cause. For me, I've always been interested in other things. There's people fighting that fight, and for me, my interest has gone other ways. And in fact, I don't even really bring him up in the book. But in The Spirit of Crazy Horse by Peter Matheson, brings him up quite a bit. And there's still a lot of people really working on his behalf, if that's a cause you believe in.
Well, thank you for calling, Lorna. And we're going to take a quick break. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. We're talking about life for Native Americans today. What is life like on the res? If you've been to a res or lived on one, what was your experience like? 866-798-8255. It's your call. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW San Francisco, and we would like to thank everyone who made our May membership campaign a success. More than 2,500 listeners, including 585 new members, pledged over $262,000 to support local public radio. And because of that support, KALW is on track to end the fiscal year with a modest surplus. Listeners who decide to get involved make everything possible at KALW. And thank you.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. Tomorrow, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. We'll discuss coverage of the NATO summit and protests. Much of the focus was on the future of Afghanistan. On Sunday, 50 veterans threw their medals toward the summit, saying no amount of medals or flags can cover the amount of human suffering caused by the occupation. That's tomorrow. On Monday, we will rebroadcast a conversation we had about how farm workers are organizing to gain their rights. And Tuesday, we'll have a conversation about the new documentary, Food Stamped, which is about people living on food stamps. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about life on the res, and we are joined by David Truer. He's author of the new book, Res Life, An Indian's Journey Through Reservation Life. He's the author of three novels and a book of literary criticism. He's a professor of literature and creative writing at USC. And we are also joined by one of David's students, Krista King. She's an American Indian undergrad student at Bemidji State University. She's 25, taking the course Writing on the Res. It's a month-long course that brings students to Leech Lake Reservation for a month-long immersion writing experience where they study and work with Native American students. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. And now I would like to welcome Kellen Sisk Franco to the show. Kellen is chief and spiritual leader of the Winnemem Wintu tribe. She is the fifth leader of the tribe. They are from the McLeod River watershed area. And today is the first day of the war dance designed to help them be heard and make way for change, specifically for young women. Hi, Kellen. Welcome to the show. You're joining us from Reading.
Yes, thank you.
It's great to have you. So a lot is going to happen over the next couple of days. Hundreds of people are expected to join you and support your cause. Can you give us an update? What's been happening?
So far, we're basically moving into camp and setting up and trying to get organized and seeing how many people actually do come out. We're still dealing with the Forest Service and trying to get some negotiations going on, but that's very, very slow.
And so talk about the controversy here and just the struggle that you've been facing for many years on this very issue.
I think the biggest thing is that, you know, like this is about people on who live on reservations and the kinds of things that have happened on reservations. But we're a tribe that was promised reservation, and we're existing without the promises. And the places on the river that we are attached to and that we have a sacred relationship with should have been the promised reservation lands after taking the lake. And so, you know, it's a different kind of perspective about promises the United States has made and not followed through with. And then our struggle to continue on with a tribal way of life without any rights.
And what happens when the war dance is conducted? It's just there was a shocking video that was posted, I think it was last year, of some students on a boat, and there was really no respect for the ceremony that was going on.
Right, and that's basically what's happening now. You know, there's articles in the Reading Record Searchlight that you could pull up online and see the comments from the area here is that, you know, there really has not been any change or education for the common folk around here to understand the plight of the California Indians or the promises of how they got the land and any respect for traditional rights to exist. You know, they've deemed to think that all of the California Indians should just be Americans. Stop doing those things because it bothers us. You know, you can't close that part of the lake because it's our lake now.
David, are you familiar with the Winnemem Wintu struggles?
I'm not.
What would you like to say to Kellen about this? I mean, talking about sharing your story. This gets quite a bit of attention around this time of year.
Well, what's the question?
Do you have any questions or comments for Kellen about their struggle and what they're going through?
Well, I guess I'd like to know more. I'm so new to California, and I just moved out there, so a lot of the issues that are affecting people out there on a day-to-day basis, I'm just now learning, so I apologize for not knowing more, but I would like to hear more.
So, Kalene, what would you like people, like Native people around the country, to know about your struggles?
Well, I think that Native people around the country need to know that the definitions of recognition created this big vacuum of unrecognized. And the unrecognized are discriminated against to the degree that nobody should have put up with it. It's like slaves and the freedmen. And recognized tribes should not be pushing the recognition in the faces of those who did not make that list, for whatever the reasons are, that we as Indian people need to come together and create a solidarity for respect for traditions and religions to continue on into the future, recognized or not, reservation or not, that we are given the responsibilities to sing to our springs, to dance for our lands, to pray in those places that have always been there from time immemorial. And that even though we don't have the rights, everything that we do, every time we gather our medicines, it's against the law. Every time we put our footsteps down to dance, it's against the law. Every time we bury our people in the cemetery that was created by the government, we now break the law, because it's held by BLM instead of BIA. And BLM doesn't allow burials. So there's a lot of injustices, you know, and around the world, you know, the president signed the UN DRIP, which is the Declaration of Indigenous Peoples' Rights. And right now, you know, it's being violated.
And Kalene, we're also joined by Krista King. She's an American Indian undergrad student at Bemidji State University in Minnesota. And I'm sure she'd love to hear about the war dance and how the young women are involved. And just, you know, give us an explanation and talk about the significance of the war dance.
Well, the war dance isn't something that we do all the time. It's done when we are at odds with what else to do. What else can happen? Because we need some direction from the spiritual world, the sacred places, to open doors, to change this. That's what the war dance is about. You know, we're doing a war dance because we want to hold a Bosos Tona ceremony for the coming of age of our women. And we're being kept from doing that by laws, by U.S. federal agencies who took our land without any compensation. We're in a position where local people have no understanding of what that means and how that should be allowed, because they don't want it, and so it shouldn't be. You know, it's the bottom line of trying to make changes to the better, to the good. You know, in our language, it's hupchonas is the word for that, but it translates into the closest thing to war dance. But the communication problems exist between our language and English. You know, and it's the same with, like, you know, the terminology chief. We don't really have that language in our tribe. What I would be called is a Tlahit, and a Tlahit would translate into the closest thing that you can tag on to would be chief, but it really falls short. The chief word falls short of what a slahi is.
And so, Kalene, I understand that the main problem is that you're wanting to do a ceremony for young women over the 4th of July weekend, but authorities won't close the river?
Right.
And so you're trying to raise awareness about that now?
Right. Well, you know, the lake is 321 miles of lake. We are asking for 400 yards to do this ceremony. And even if it's a busy weekend and everybody says, oh, yeah, 4th of July, you know, we have to celebrate our independence, that we have a right to recreate and drive drunk if we want to. But isn't that lake big enough that would allow us the same opportunity to do what we need to do without Duncan Burgers coming up a five-mile zone to a dead end to turn around and go back out.
Hey, Krista, I'm curious, what are your thoughts on this story, hearing Kellyn talk about this ceremony for young women?
I'm curious as to why the authorities aren't stepping in, or why it's such a big issue. And then at the same time, I don't mean to offend her or anything, but I'm curious as to, is there a reason why it's on the 4th of July weekend? Is that relevant to the war dance at all?
No. The ceremony for young girls is determined by the full moon, and it's also determined by the flowers. It's determined by the sacred rocks and the sacred mountain where they need to be, and it's determined because the lake is so full right now. We would prefer to go in April or May when the flowers are full, but we can't because the lake is too high. The lake right now is 10 feet over our dance ground, and it's 25 feet over our sacred rock. We have to wait till the water is drafted off the lake, which will be around July, to access those sacred places. And the first full moon that we can do that is in July. And so it's not like we can change it. I mean, they celebrate 4th of July different days every year. But the full moon is always the full moon.
Well, Kellyn, I know that you have to go to the ceremony. You've got a busy day, and thanks so much for taking some time to talk with us, and we'll be following this.
Thank you, Colleen.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Good
thanks,
luck with
Kellyn.
With your fight.
That is Kellyn Sisk. She's chief and spiritual leader of the Winamum Wintu tribe. You can find more information about their struggle and the war dance at yourcallradio.org. And we're talking today about life on reservations, life struggles facing Native Americans, and the stories they want to tell. And it sure is a diverse, you can't really paint it with a broad brush, which is what often happens. And that's one of the points of today's guest's, David Troyer's book, Res Life, An Indian's Journey Through Reservation Life, is to get past the sort of stereotypes that we hear in the media. There are so many stories that he tells in his book, and we will ask him to tell a few in just a couple minutes. We actually have full lines, so we'll get to your phone calls in just a minute. And we are also joined by Krista Kling. She's an American Indian undergrad student at Bemidji State University, and she's taking David's course, Writing on the Res. And let's go through a few phone calls. Let's hear from Shan in San Francisco. Hi, Shan.
Hi. Once again, you have found a topic that warms my heart.
Thank you, Shan.
I have two things. David, I'm going to ask you a question in a moment. But in hearing, this brought back a beautiful memory to me of people who were American Indians. They were having a wedding ceremony in Golden Gate Park among the trees. And they gave away all their possessions. Potlatch. I had never seen anything like it. And it was so beautiful. The generosity. So as a wordsmith, the word reservation, I don't know where it came from, but the word preservation, I think, is a great word. But when I heard Rose announcing this program that was coming up, when she said res, the hair on the back of my head stood up a little bit. And I thought, is this a word that should be reserved for the people who are American Indians? And I know it's in the title of the book, but I just thought, you know, there are certain words that belong to certain cultures. And I didn't know how you might feel about other people using the word res in a rather cavalier way.
Is that a question for me, Shan?
It is for you, David.
Thank you. Thank you for your call, too. Well, you know what? Of course, I never really like much that any Cavaliers do, except for the basketball team. So I can understand how it might make you uncomfortable that some people seem cavalier when they use the word. But on the other hand, the perception is that there's such a divide between Native lives and other lives that never the twain shall meet. And I think that's a false perception. I think there's lots of ways that as American Indians, as Americans, as different peoples who have many, many more shared values than we have values that, that separate us. I think, you know, a little more familiarity with us and our lives and where we live isn't a bad thing at all.
What are your thoughts, Krista, about the word res?
I don't know. I guess it didn't. I've lived on Leech Lake all my life. It just was kind of part of my daily culture. I didn't realize that other people, it was struck them as different. And I don't know. It doesn't bother me to have other people say it. People I don't know, like someone like, oh, something about the res. And I'm like, yeah, that's right.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Shan. Let's hear next from Jeff in Sonoma. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on. Hopefully it's not too loud. I'm driving to work. I grew up in Minnesota. My parents, both my mom and my dad, and my grandparents on my mom's side grew up in Menomon County, in Menomon and also near Waubun. And I actually have a very small fraction of Ojibwe blood in me. My mom's side of the family, my grandmother, was very quiet about it. She died a couple of years ago in her mid-90s, and I think of the older generation was interesting, and maybe it's just Minnesotans, but they were very quiet about it, and I suspect she was maybe embarrassed because she had Native American blood in her. And it's just a very interesting phenomenon, but I want to contrast that, just sort of their personal quietness about it, with both my grandparents. Both my mom's parents were teachers in the very early 30s, 40s, and 50s in the Menomon School District, and they spent a lot of time in Natahwash and other Native American towns there, and I just think that they clearly, my whole life growing up with them, never treated them differently. They treated everybody, even though Menomon County lies within the White Earth Indian Reservation, everybody sort of treated each other just as sort of neighbors and friends, and maybe it's just unique to Menomon County and the White Earth Indian Reservation. But I didn't think anyone really felt like any animosities or any differences. It was like we're all part of the same thing. And granted, part of their life was in the Great Depression. And I was a beneficiary in many ways. I met many folks. I've been to Natahwash, to Twin Lakes, to Itasca many times and met many Native Americans. And what I thought was interesting is just anecdotally, folks that would come up, elderly folks come up to my grandparents late in their lives at the Shooting Star Casino at brunch or something, and just hug my grandparents and say what a impact they made in their lives. And, you know, these were Native American folks that were, you know, hugging my grandparents. My grandfather was, you know, Czech in origin, but my grandmother had a small amount of Ojibwe in her. Anyways, that's my comment. So I'm not sure how it is elsewhere, but I think from my small perspective of Menomon, it was I thought people were very respectful of each other.
Jeff, it's really funny because our class, we actually drove down through Natahwash and Twin Lakes and down to McCraney Lake. And we spent the whole day down there in Menomon County just yesterday. And you point out something, you know, one part that's forgotten and one part that's elided. I mean, I think you're right in pointing out that, you know, people mixed and intermarried and worked together and learned from each other. And there was, in many instances, like you remember, a lot of mutual respect and trust and togetherness. I mean, back in those days, everybody was poor, Native and non-Native in areas like that. And people really had to work together on one hand. On the other hand, I think there is a legacy of in Menomon County on White Earth of people having their land expropriated and being denied access to places where they traditionally would hunt and fish, losing their land during the allotment process, being X'd out of jobs in those small towns, and there weren't many jobs to begin with in places like Menomon and Waubun. So there is also a legacy of dispossession and anger around that, which is ongoing. So on one hand, I think you're absolutely right that there's more togetherness than we remember. But there's also important historical facts that we should also remember and honor and try to fix.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in. Let's go next to Scott in Oakland. Hi, Scott.
Hi. I just wanted to mention an anecdote from my time in high school. I lived in Winslow, Arizona, and it billed itself as the gateway to the Navajo Nation and the Hopi Reservation. And there were a lot of Indians from the reservation that went to my high school. And I remember landing there from back east as a high school student, and the culture shock was vivid and nearly pervasive. I'll cut straight to the quick, though. The main thing that disturbed me as an outsider coming to town was how much abuse and neglect a lot of the natives took, and it seemed like they were too demoralized to fight back. It was very depressing to see, and I could recount lots of instances of it. But then along came the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement and other movements that made the news, and the attitudes generated in the other primarily urban areas filtered into town and caught on in a way that was, you know, clearly discernible by a lot of the local element of the population, particularly among younger Hopis and Navajos, who seem to hold their heads higher and walk with more confidence and stop taking a lot of crap that had been dished out to them. And I can only say that it was a welcome sight, and I remember those days quite well, and I was impressed by that. It kind of gave me hope that no matter how dark the days get, there's a flame that burns in every population, and if the right set of circumstances come along, you can see people surmount all kinds of incredible odds. And I saw a lot of wonderful things happen in those days. I just wanted to send a shout out to people back on the res and to Winslow in those days, because I was impressed very much by what I saw.
Well, thank you for the story, Scott. And we'll get a response, but we have a number of other callers who've been waiting patiently, so I just want to go through them, and then we'll get responses from David and Krista. Let's hear from Ray in Santa Cruz. Hi, Ray.
Hi. Thanks for a great show. I want to give a quick little experience that I had years ago in Big Mountain, Black Mesa Reservation down in Arizona. It's amazing what still goes on down there. The Bureau of Indian Affairs, I mean, still to this day, I've got reports of just this year where they were stealing DNA people's horses down there. I've seen, over the years, I've kept in touch with a number of people. We went down there to repair their houses on the reservation down there, that they're people being displaced by Peabody coal. They don't have water. They've got a wedge driven between the Hopi and the Diné people down there, too, by taking the Hopi people and giving them houses with water and power and guns and badges and making them part of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And, you know, it's a whole big game, you know, in order to control resources. And our U.S. government is still backing a lot of the things that go on there, including, you know, breaking all the treaties, every treaty they've ever signed with Native Americans. But I also wanted to put out there that I've written a song that a friend of mine, Stephen Graves, recorded. It's available on a website called the White Buffalo Project. It's whitebuffaloproject.com. And there are several Native American groups that you can do quick donations to by downloading the song for $1. And all the 100% of the money goes straight to groups like Native Warmth that makes really thick blankets that they send back to Pine Ridge every year for people that, you know, people freeze to death there in the winter. And like the Lakota Children's Legal Fund, where people are Native people are having their children still taken from them by the U.S. government and, having a hard time getting them back. So there are groups out there that are helping, try and help support the Natives who have been so downtrodden ever since white men reached these shores.
Well, thank you, Ray. I just got your email, and we'll put a link to your project on our site. David, you write in your book, you extensively write about history with the treaties and just the origin of reservations. During the research process, did anything really stand out for you or surprise you?
Yeah, a lot of things surprised me. Most of it surprised me. You know, a lot of people write books because they're expert on that thing, but I guess I felt that way incorrectly when I started writing the book, because it quickly became clear to me that I was writing this book not because I was an expert, but because actually I wasn't, and I wanted to be. I wanted to know. And so I had no real good way of conceptualizing why, when did we start having casinos and why, and how did that happen? And what is a public law 280 reservation versus one that's not? And what were the full ramifications of the Marshall Trilogy decisions regarding the Cherokee in the 1830s? And all this stuff I didn't know, and so it was a big process of finding out. And so there were surprises left, right, and center, but the most... One of the most arresting surprises was no matter what issue I was following, whether it was an issue about native languages or about land or about treaties or about fishing or families like kids and adoption, how often my research took me back to court. It seems like litigation and court cases and Supreme Court decisions and all of this stuff was, you could always find a court case.
Mm-hmm.
And that was surprising. But you know, but there were lots of other surprises too, and it was a tough balance to point out. I did not want to write a book about historical injustice. That was not what I was after. That's not what I wanted to do. I was not trying to correct the record and point out yet again how. And although I appreciate, you know, Ray's work, you know, I don't want to write a book about how downtrodden we are. Mm-hmm. I wanted, conversely, to write a book about how interesting and complex and vivid and troubled and gifted and interesting and intelligent and all those things at once our lives are. That's what I wanted to write about. Well, I wanted to capture complexity.
Well, I think you succeeded, and those are the best kinds of books, and I definitely learned a lot from the history. So thank you so much for joining us. David Truer is author of Res Life, An Indian's Journey Through Reservation Life, and Krista King, I'm sorry, Krista, there was a capital L in your name, so I called you Kling, but Krista King is an American Indian undergrad student at Bemidji State University. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, Rose.
And thanks so much for your phone calls and emails. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of the NATO summit and protests. Much of the focus was on the future of Afghanistan. On Sunday, 50 veterans threw their medals toward the summit, saying no amount of medals or flags can cover the amount of human suffering. We'll be joined by Truthout's Yana Kunich, The Independent's Arun Gupta, and The Guardian's Emma Graham Harrison. Where did you see the best reporting this week? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor. And Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Alan Farley is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in San Francisco. Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.